Who knows how long this taxi ride will be, because we're travelling to a slightly different location than we were last time. Myself and Jonathan McDonald were sat in the back of a cab, but it's nice to be sat in the back of a cab with you again.
Thanks, mate. It's good to be here. I think this feels a bit different, because last time it was minus 17, I think. And today the phone says it's 1 degree, so it's 18 different is how I feel. 18.
And we were so concerned about our extremities snapping off, we probably didn't even think about our intremities. Our interiors have been a little bit battered recently. We've both suffered some kind of allergy. You managed to find some glorious medication last night in the shape of a historically relevant red medicine made from grape juice. I didn't partake in possibly as much as I should have, because you've woken up bright, breezy, ready for action. I feel a little bit like this taxi should have a blue flashing light on top, taking me to somewhere more permanently horizontal. Today we're once again working with Hyper Island, and I can't help but find myself in a fortuitous situation for years and years, being involved in stories without even knowing that stories were going to become suddenly very fashionable, yeah. And everybody realizing that you can use them as a weapon, you can use them as a means of entertainment, you can use them to emotionally inspire, to get people to lower their guards and then cram information in when they're not looking.
Yeah, or even better still, flood them with adverts. No, hold on. No, is that no, that's not right?
That's not why you're here this time.
Is that no?
No.
Oh, hold on. Let me get the brief. Hold on. I've got to find the brief again.
Although we're kind of made of similar DNA, you're almost the yin to my yang when it comes to. You come from a history of business experiences, a history of. You say yourself, successful failures.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, my most of my life I have managed to successfully orchestrate disasters that by mistake at the time. I mean, my biggest disaster, none of it's a mistake, but the largest disaster that I was involved with, I was actually the chief exec of a Sky TV channel, and remortgaged my house and put everything into it, you know, and that went horribly wrong. But it's an interesting thing that you learn after having four massive failures in my life. I've realised quite succinctly the fundamental practices of business, the most basic of which is that stuff that costs more than you're making is not good. But that's like a minor one, but there are lots of really more slightly more complicated ones. But at the end of the day, if you don't actually have those failures, then it's very hard to realize what underpins the stuff beneath the spiky haircut gurus.
How do businesses stop being lazy? Let's say Jessup's, for example, totally aware of what was going on in the world but didn't make the connection. There was Amazon selling cameras cheaper than themselves. They're every morning waking up, opening up shop. Obviously, it's not the management's issue here, it's higher up, but they're thinking, oh, not again, how are we going to compete with this? What stopped them from actually doing something about it?
Well, I think there is, my view is that the there's three things at play. The first is your understanding of what's going on, your perspective, if you like. The second one is your capability of what you have inside, you know, the internal what's going on. And the third one is what you're going to do about it. So those three components may have broken at all three stages, but probably at the first stage, which was to understand that Amazon, or rather than blame Amazon, for instance, online trading in general was a shift from the way that people consumed in the olden days to the way that people expect consumption to be today. And so what they may have done is thought, okay, well, now Amazon are another retailer that we are competing with, which actually in itself would have been the wrong thing to think about. What they should have thought about is, well, let's look at how competition looks. Our cost base is massive amount of retail premises, huge amount of staff. We're competing with people, sometimes with no retail premises, and sometimes with very few staff. And it's not just price that does it, it's also service. So if someone uses Jessop's, for instance, as a showroom, this is called showrooming in retail land, and then goes and buys from elsewhere, and you're Jessop's, what do you do about that situation? But it's easy to say after, you know, the body's not even cold yet, but it's easy to say this is what they should have done. But I would place a large amount of money on the fact that it's going to be down to either how they understood or didn't understand what the external world was, what they understood and what they were able to do inside, and thirdly, what strategies and decision-making processes they put in place, if at all.
Could they have done anything? Because obviously they didn't necessarily focus on any unique selling points that they may or may not have had. I mean, you brought up a good point there about service. I mean, I loved going to my Jessop's more than anything else, and they, for a while, had the ability to be a bit flexible with the price, so I did shop with them. But the moment that flexibility left and I couldn't haggle or price match with online, I did just go there for my advice and then shop online, which they knew, and it was a tragedy. And I wish, because I had a good relationship with the staff who on this occasion really knew their stuff, but do they know as much as the people commenting in the online marketplaces?
No, that's right. And I think a friend of mine called Ollie was the manager of Jessop's in Oxford Street, so it's quite a close subject to my heart. The reality is if you're competing purely on price, which Jessop's were, there were the price and location, theoretically, until location was shifted to be online and offline. But if you're going to compete largely on, we'll beat whatever price you find, then you're inside a negative vortex. You're a race to the bottom, which is like how mobile phone companies, for instance, and mobile networks have found themselves in the competitive vortex of giving away more and more and more, cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. Whereas what good would look like is if you actually end up with customers with a higher average revenue per user, a higher purchase rate, higher expenditure, because they value what's happening more and more and more. But that seems to be so tremendously complicated for companies to add more value. It's more about, in their eyes, not extracting more value, using more techniques to gain more revenue. But that's not what business should be about. It should be about value exchange. And actually, it turns out that it shouldn't be about revenue either. It should be about profitability. A profitable value exchange isn't about revenue-generating discounting. And without sounding too harsh on Jessop's standpoint, it's a fairly basic business principle. If you're inside a price war competition and you're dealing with people who don't have any of your overheads, it's extraordinarily likely you're going to end up dead.
Who, without knowing it, may well be going the same way?
I think that it would be interesting to look at any company that is being disrupted by things that don't necessarily look like a disruptive force. So, for instance, if you're in the game of selling data that's transmitted via masts, one could argue that the fiber optic connectivity or the wireless connectivity of things, along with the capability and affordability of technology and devices, would mean that it isn't as tenable moving forward to monetize things that you can actually get free. Now, people will think, yes, but I know what you're saying here. What you're saying is that communication can't be charged for, but it can. Plus also, Wi-Fi and WiMAX is not very good quality and it's not everywhere yet, which is exactly what Kodak thought when the cameras went into Nokia phones. And it's exactly what Singer sewing machines thought when threads got stronger. It's like, yeah, but there's people will always want to sew and repair things. And Kodak thought people always want to buy individual cameras, and mobile networks may well feel that people always want to spend money being locked into contracts. I don't know whether or not you feel sociologically that's the trend.
People get romantic about stuff, don't they? The mending over the disposing, which is the right mindset for Singer to have had, but it was that, you know, led to their demise. This huge, huge, huge organisation. When I asked you to come up with an example, I didn't expect you to come up with something that affects every single person in the country, maybe beyond, well, especially in America at the moment, with a mobile handset, because that's quite an epic realization that the infrastructure that already exists with a little bit of an investment, say for example half the price of a train proposal.
There you go. Well, I mean, 30 billion quid for a high speed rail network could go a long way if you think about, I mean, without being too, we have the fortune of sitting in a comfy car in the middle of Stockholm speaking into a microphone. The reality is that you never know in the situations how complicated business really is. Mm. So with respect to those people and the people involved, my only advice, my final piece of advice is it would be fortuitous to sometimes think what would happen if it turns out we are actually being disrupted right now, but we can't see it.
Yeah. Imagine those boardrooms that may or may not exist. Yes. And the conversations going on in them. We've arrived at our boardroom.
There you go. Well done. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you again.
Cheers, guys. Bye.